made a rookie mistake there, but it wasn't the one that I thought I'd made when I talked to people afterwards. So it's, okay, so we had last time this expression that Z, you know, and we had that Z3 was 1. I write it, I want to write it in a particular way now. 6 pi squared 1 over d minus 4. I guess I was using little d before. Plus non-pole things, but the pole coefficient, I used to write this with, it was 2 minus d over 4 with a minus sign up front, and I just want to write it explicitly as pole and d minus 4. I think that's what I told you last time. Now, the logic of what I told you last time was true. E naught doesn't depend on mu, and we're going to, the mu dependence of E, the implicit mu dependence of E, has to cancel any explicit mu dependence. But I garbled how that has to work, because to tell you how E runs as a function of mu has to involve the definition of E, because it's renormalized. So I need to be more precise about what minimal subtraction is. And so in another way of writing this would be that the bare thing was equal to the renormalized center. Remember, there's always the bare thing had a factor of mu to the 4 minus d on dimensional grounds, because the renormalized coupling is dimensionless, and E naught really isn't dimensionless unless you're in 4 dimensions. So if I put the factors of mu back in that were part of the definition of E, then I have E, which depends implicitly on mu, plus a bunch of pole terms. And here, at one loop, we got a simple pole, but at higher loops, we could have got double poles and higher. So we would have had, in general, some Lorentz series here. And this could depend on the coupling constant. So minimal subtraction is the statement that the renormalized piece, we just drop all the pole stuff. We said take the renormalized coupling and define it to be the thing independent of the poles. So what we're asking is that this thing be independent of D. So if you change scale, if you take mu goes to, you know, lambda mu or something like that, then you can kind of see what's going to happen here. Let's say it's mu to the 1 plus epsilon or something like that. So it's a small change in scale. Then you can kind of see that the factor mu to the 4 minus d out front is going to go to mu to the 4 minus d times, you know, 1 plus epsilon 4 minus d, you know, plus higher orders. And so you're picking up factors of 4 minus d here, which when I multiply them through here are going to now start mixing up the powers of d minus 4. And so in particular, if I'm going to define the thing that's independent of d minus 4 to be the minimally subtracted coupling, there's going to, you know, the fact that changes in mu change where the d's go, because it's starting to shuffle around terms in this Lorentz series by multiplying them through by 4 minus d. And in particular, taking the pole term and multiplying it by 4 minus d gives you something which is in here. That shows you that the E has to be depending on mu if I'm defining it to be the thing independent of d, because the thing independent of the poles will change depending on exactly how you change the scales because of these factors of d minus 4 that are appearing in the scaling of mu up front. So a more careful calculation of how E runs would be taken by demanding that what we know is that mu, the E naught d mu is 0. So the explicit mu dependence here is canceling the implicit mu dependence. And so if we just differentiate through, that's the differential of this thing will give us 4 minus d times, you know, E plus sum equals 1 bn. And then if we differentiate this, we call Let me call beta sub d mu e d mu. I'm allowing this to depend on d because there's going to be a dependence on d coming from here that I want to keep track of. So I'll get a piece here which is plus 1 plus some equals 1 to infinity of bn prime. So bn prime is db de. So this one, you know, the beta here comes just from mu d mu of e. And then there's an implicit one in here coming from the derivative of that. And I'm allowing this to depend on d in the sense that I'll think of this as being the honest-to-God beta function plus some series of some coefficients. Let me call them kappa and d minus 4, some positive powers of d minus 4. So as d goes to 4, this d-dependent thing will go to the beta function that we're interested in. But you're going to see that we're going to need these kind of terms here because the consistency of this equation, if we start equating powers of d minus 4, is going to require it. So let's... yeah. I'm just dropping that, yeah. Just because it's equal to zero, so I can divide it up. Okay, so now what I want to do. So what we can do is we can start looking at powers of 4 minus d. So if I put this into here, you can kind of see if I look for a positive a power of d minus 4 squared or higher, I'll never get that here, right? Because here I've got negative powers of d minus 4, and I've multiplied by, through by at most one power. And I'll not get it from here, but I can get it from here. I can only get it from here, where n is equal to 2 or higher. So if I look at the coefficient of d minus 4 for the n, with n bigger than or equal to 2, this equation. What I want to do is just basically take this thing and write it as a series in d minus 4 and equate it every term to 0 because this is supposed to be true for all d. So the terms for d minus 4 to the n for higher n are basically just saying that that kappa n is 0 for n bigger than or equal to 2.
Could,
yeah?
Could you get mixed terms from the series to kappa in the brackets here?
Which series and which
bracket? Before the beta d, that it's 1 plus a series in d minus 4, right? So if you multiply that by a series in d minus 4 to positive powers, then don't you get terms for that, from that as well? So if you beta, you have 2 to the power 6 or something, and then in the series you have to the minus 2, you have to the fourth power.
So if, for example, you're saying that, for instance, I take 1 over d minus 4 squared term and hit a d minus 4 squared term, that'll give me d minus 4 to the 0 term.
Right.
So when I d minus 4 is 0, I'll have to follow that?
No, but if you take the d to the minus 2 in the series there and you take d to the 16th in the series over there, you get a positive power, right? You get two. So you're not saying that they all have to be 0, you're saying that some sums of them have to be 0.
Yeah, but they all involve kappa. The only way I'm going to get all of them to be 0 is to have all the kappas vanish for n bigger than or equal to 2. But I think you're worried that if I take a...
It's actually a way. I'm not seeing why that definitely has to be the only way to do that.
So it's a linear set of equations. So if you find one root, you've found them all, right? It's... Basically, that's the condition. Is that the? I think what you're saying is right. You're saying that if I follow the, if I look for d minus 4 squared in this term, I'll get that from. I'll get a factor here from k2, and I'll get a factor here from k3 times b1 plus k4 times b2. But they have to all vanish for all n bigger than 2, and the way to have that happen will be to have all these k's vanish. Because You'll see that, because I haven't got to the next terms yet, you'll see what's different once you get below n equals 2. But what's happening in all those terms is they're all coming from the kappas. What's going to start happening once you engage this term is that there's a trade-off between what's happening on this side and what's happening on this side, and so that there are solutions which are not zero.
So, Cliff, what is beta of E? You said it's the real beta.
What's what?
Beta of E. Yeah.
This as opposed to this, you mean?
Yeah.
It's just the
it's
so
the,
this,
D, the D equals 4 sort of term of that.
This is the thing that you would get as D equals to 4. And you might have thought that why have it depend on D at all? And I'm about to show you why kappa 1 can't be 0. So if I take D minus 4 to the 1, you know, where does that appear? Well, it's going to appear here. So we'll get a factor of the coefficient of D minus 4 will be minus E, because it was 4 minus D here. And that's the only thing from here. And then over here, we're going to get plus. The only way we can get a linear term in D minus 4 will be to have kappa 1 come over and hit the 1 here, because this is always lower to lower power. So we'll get plus kappa 1. So that tells us what kappa 1 has to be. Kappa 1 has to be minus S E plus E. I do the same thing for D minus 4 to the 0. Here I'm going to pick up minus B1. And here I'll get, when beta multiplies 1, I'll get contribution. And then also, since I have a linear term here in D minus 4, that'll pick off the 1 over D minus 4 term. So I'll get a plus kappa 1 B1 prime. So that tells us that I can solve that. So beta is equal to B1 minus kappa Z B1 prime. If I do the D minus 4 to the minus 1 term, I'm going to get minus B2. Excuse me. To get an inverse term here, I'll never get it here because that's always positive powers. I'll get a term here. If I take the minus 1 term times beta, I'll get B1 prime times beta plus B2 prime times kappa 1. And what I can do is I can solve this for B2 in terms of, so we know what beta is. We know what kappa 1 is from these two equations. So we can think of this as being solving for B2 and so on. And if I just keep on going down the sequence, we're just going to find conditions that tell me, you know, B3 in terms of B1 and B2 and so on, and so on. So the whole story here is going to be given by B1. You tell me what B1 is, I can tell you what everything is. But B1 is the thing you'd have to calculate. So these equations, so the remainder of these equations give B in sub n in terms B1. Okay. So in our example, we know what B1 is. That's the single pole thing. So if we go up there and look at what we had E naught was Z3 so that's 1 minus e squared over 12 pi squared. I've done that right. I guess I'm switching between capital D and little d. So let me just. So that tells us what b is, right? So that's so we're looking at that equation basically. I could have put the mu. I should have put the mu back in here. So we would have had mu 4 minus d if we put that back in. So if we take this and read off what b is, you can see that b1 is the way it's defined is just the coefficient of d minus 4. So it's minus b squared over 12 pi squared cubed. So that says that b1, so e times b1 prime, I differentiate, I pull down a 3, I'll get minus e cubed over 4 pi squared. And so now what we want is beta. So that's b1 minus e b1 prime. And you can kind of see I'm going to have minus a 12th plus a 4th will be plus e cubed over 6 pi squared. And all I was essentially following last term was, the last time was this one. And so you can see that the sign changed, right? That was negative, but the result's positive. And the result's positive because I wasn't being careful enough in following how E has to depend on mu in such a way as to keep the powers of 4 minus D that are coming from the explicit mu to the 4 minus D from messing around with these poles in minimal subtraction. So this is where the sign came from. Okay. Right. So let's go back to the where we were. So we were looking at the physical interpretation of the vacuum polarization. So we had we were looking at scattering of big massive charges. So we imagine that we had something. And we should think of this as being something heavier than the electron, because we looked at radiative corrections. And we were interested in following what this thing, this graph was doing, where this was an electron. And this is, say, a muon. And I was never actually looking at exchange graphs. So I was always implicitly in describing scattering, thinking of these things as being distinguishable. So you can think of that as being a muon and a proton or something like that. But the important thing was they're heavier than the electron, because that allowed us to drop things like, you know, there'd be other graphs like, the heavy guy could be going around the loop. Or there could be graphs where we do a radiative correction on the external line. And these, you're gonna see that this is gonna give us a contribution to what we're interested in, which goes like 1/ the electron mass squared. And these things in a similar way will give us 1/ whatever this heavier mass would have been. And the same thing would be true here. So as long as these things that are scattering are very massive compared to electrons, all these things we can ignore compared to this one was the rationale. So then we're taking this thing for non-relativistic scattering and we're comparing it to potential scattering. So as a spin independent. Potential scattering. Where the potential was given by the explicit expression, you know, V of R was the product of the charges divided by 2 pi cubed integral d3q of e to the I q dot r over q squared 1 plus pi f of q squared. Well, that's our vacuum polarization thing. So we had evaluated this thing to give us pi mu nu. Was q squared eta mu nu minus q mu q nu times pi q q squared. So this is the effective potential that captures the same kind of scattering as we would have gotten from this thing. And what you're supposed to do is think of this as being suggestive, because one, you know, so the one term here is Coulomb scattering. So the 1 over 3 q squared corresponds to v of r being essentially 1 over, you know, 1 over r. So having something, a function of q squared times that, that's not any old potential. That's like the convolution of the Coulomb potential with some charge distribution. You know, if you have a convolution in position space, that'll become multiplication in momentum space. So we can make that explicit. So the Coulomb potential of a charge distribution . So in position space, it would have been, you know, phi of r would be the integral d3x of rho of x over r minus x. But in momentum space, that would have been 1 over 2 pi cubed integral d3q e to the I q dot r over q squared times a rho of q, where rho is the Fourier transform of rho in position space. So the convolution here between rho and the Coulomb potential becomes just the multiplication in position space. So if you can kind of pair that to that, you can see that what we're looking at here is it's as if we have a charge distribution, and the charge distribution is some, you know, each charge q is appearing directly in the Coulomb potential, but then there's a correction to it, which is a you know, so if we write rho, instead of writing the charge q, we write it as being q plus say 1 plus some local distribution, which I'm going to call eta. So we write this as being rho. I want to write this as being q times a delta function, which is the original charge, plus some new distribution, eta of r. So we define this. Then this is going to correspond to the point charge that gave us the Coulomb interaction. And this correction charge distribution is going to be the thing that corresponds to pi. And if I equate, you know, the potential energy, the scattering from the Coulomb potential, if I take the scattering from a Coulomb potential from this charge distribution, I can equate it to this and ask what would be the charge distribution that corresponds to pi. And the scattering the eta of r that reproduces given by pi f of q is So there's a long song and dance in the notes here, but it basically, the answer is very simple. You know, what you're going to expect to find is that if we look in momentum space, the thing we're looking at here is the Fourier transform of the charge distribution. So we should be expecting this to be the Fourier transform of the charge distribution. One is the Fourier transform of a delta function. That's good. So what we should expect to find is that basically the Fourier transform of eta is pi f. And that happens. So eta is, if you put in all the factors of 2 and things, And so, you know, the inverse Fourier transform would have said that, I guess pi f of q squared is probably 2 times integral d3 r of e to the minus I q dot r a of r. And in particular, if I take q equals 0, pi f of 0, which you remember was 0, that was our renormalization condition for it, is basically proportional to the integral d3r of eta of r. Once q is equal to 0, the phase goes away. So that tells you something which is reasonable as well. It says that the charge distribution you're getting from pi has the property that if I integrate this charge distribution over all space, I get 0. So it's a polarization. It's not adding charge. It's taking the charge and it's smearing it around in physically the way you would have expected from polarization. If you stick in pairs of charges and let them separate in the Coulomb field, then you haven't added net charge, but you put a distribution of charge in that you didn't have before. So this is expressing the fact that that there's no net charges added. And so what you're looking at is a polarization. So that's a kind of a constraint on everything we find. On just if you chase through the one halves, where did that come from? I mean, I might have forgot to write it there. No, it becomes about because if you're scattering two charges, you know, you've got the first charge and a second charge, and they each have a polarization around them. And the scattering, there's two contributions to it. There's this charge is scattering from this polarization, and this charge is scattering from this polarization. And so that means if you strip out the charge density from that, which did not have the two, there had to be a two in this one because it's appearing twice in the potential. Okay, so we can actually go a little ways towards evaluating that because we know what pi is, right? We know pi f is explicitly given by, it was the thing that we had before, which I hope we've written down here again. Well, let me write down what 8 is. I've written down here what 8 is, but it's essentially telling you what pi f is given that I've written that. So for pi f that we've evaluated, I'm evaluating this graph. This gives eta is e squared over 2 pi to the fifth, integral from 0 to 1 dx. X 1 minus x integral d3q the I q dot r times the logarithm of 1 plus q squared over m squared x 1 minus x. So I'm just plugging in the pi that we had before into this expression. And there was that pi had an integral over x, and I've changed the order of integration of the x's. So there's a thing to be careful about here because this integral over q, you know, this is behaving for large q logarithmically in q, and then this is oscillatory. The only reason this is converging at all for large q is the oscillatory part, and so there's a delicate the convergence of this thing will be delicate for large q, but if I differentiated to say with respect to m squared or 1 over m squared, I would have pulled down a factor of 1 over q squared, and then this is q squared dq. And this q squared would give us kind of a logarithmic dependence, which is close to converging, and the oscillatory thing would make it converge. And so so for large q, if I do things like I start changing orders of integration, what I'm going to do is I'm going to, the way to evaluate this q integral is to, you know, what you're doing is you have a, in the q-plane, you're integrating from minus infinity to infinity. But you have a branch point up here when q squared is equal to, so this logarithm goes to 0 when q squared is equal to minus m squared over x, 1 minus x. So that'll be on the imaginary axis somewhere. So there's a branch cut there. And so what I'd like to do to evaluate this integral is to not do this integral, but to instead deform the contour to do that integral. And that'll converge like crazy, right? Because here q is going to be imaginary. So this is essentially going to turn into an exponential rather than an oscillatory phase. But the whole story of deforming the contours is going to come with it an ambiguity of there's essentially a constant running around a momentum space here, which is potentially divergent, and which if you deform the contours in a not careful way, you're not being careful about. So what we're going to do is I'm going to deform the contour, I'm going to do the integral, and you're going to find that the result no longer satisfies this. And that's because there's a constant piece here which is for which these manipulations where you're deforming the contour are marginal, because the fact that these integrals are only converging just barely. But the ambiguous part in that manipulation is all a constant in momentum space. But if I start differentiating with respect to m squared, I get things that are converging well enough that I can do these manipulations and it's not an issue. So once I'm finished, I'm going to find an answer which is not satisfying this, but I know how to fix it, because the thing that was being done poorly here was the constant in momentum space. And in position space, that's a delta function. So I should be going back when I'm done and put in a delta function whose coefficient I'll just demand to make this feature, that the integral over all space be 0. But don't be surprised when we get there that we're going to get an answer that has that property, because the steps I'm using to get from this line to the integral I really want to do are going to be slippery, because the convergence of the thing for large q is really dicey until I start differentiating with m squared. So what I'll do is, so if I call this contour, you know, this is the contour we start off with. Let's call this contour C or something like that. So I'm going to leave a space here, which is going to be essentially what I just said. And so what I'll do is we'll have e squared over 2 pi to the fifth. And then we'll have some integral here, which I'll do on the contour C. And it's going to converge really well, because once I'm on this contour, all the oscillatory things here are becoming exponentials, and so they're converging like crazy. So I sub C is basically this. Put on that contour. And the thing I haven't written here will be, there'll be something which I'll write like that, and I'll choose this N to guarantee that this is true, that so I'm just warning you that's going to come up, and it's going to come up because of these manipulations I'm doing. All right, so let's do it. So what's great about this kind of a contour is that, you know, we've got a logarithm here, and it's got a branch point here, and we're basically doing an integral on one side, comparing it to the integral on the other side. And you know what a logarithm does at a branch point is that it basically goes in sheets, and it comes around plus 2 pi I. Every time you go around, if I kind of circle that point. And so it's like a parking garage, that it's that if I imagine here's the branch point, you know, one of the levels is like this. And if I kind of go in the complex plane into the board and come back out, and I go around the branch point, I come back down on another level, which is below the first one by 2 pi I. And if I continue again, I'll get another level. And there's a multi-sheeted surface that we're looking at here. And what we're doing is we're comparing the value of the integrand on one side with the value on the other side. And so it's just all you're doing is you're subtracting this logarithm on the first branch from the logarithm on the second branch. And that means that the difference is going to be something, it's going to be 2 pi I. It's not going to depend on q squared. It's just going to be some number. And that's what allows you to do the integral, is that it becomes a very simple integral to do then, because all the q's are here. all the explicit views. So so if we evaluate I on the contour C, then what we're doing is we're using that, you know, the value on one side minus the value on the other side, which is the two sides of the contour, involves evaluating the logarithm of the absolute value of 1 minus, say, q squared over m squared x, 1 minus x, you know, plus I pi on one side, minus logarithm of the absolute value of 1 minus q squared over m squared x, 1 minus x, plus or minus I pi. So they differ by 2 pi I. And so that difference is just going to be 2 pi I. And so the integral that I'm going to actually write down now is going to have this logarithm replaced by essentially 2 pi I, and we're just looking at the rest of the thing. So I will be, excuse me, will be a I probably want to have a line before this one. So it was the integral d3q of e to the I q dot r times the logarithm of that's the integral we're doing. And so we can do some of the angular integrals for free, right? So there's a if I think of q, that's q, and that's r, there's an angle between them, theta. But there's also a, of the two angular integrals in q, one of them doesn't appear here at all, so that's a factor of 2 pi. The integral over this angle is easy to do because it's basically, if I call, you know, u the cosine of that angle, then the integral over that angle is essentially an integral from minus 1 to 1 du of e to the I, the modulus of q, modulus of r times u. So that integral is easy to do because that's just e to the I qr u over I qr from minus 1 to 1. So that'll be e to the I qr minus e to the minus I qr over I qr. So I'm going to get a factor here of 2 pi from the first angular integral. I'm going to get a factor of 1 over IQR from that integral. I would have had an integral left over from 0 to infinity of q squared dq. So I should leave this q inside. So I'll have a 1 over q coming from that one. I have this factor of e to the I qr minus e to the minus I qr times the logarithm. But the logarithm on this contour I can replace actually by 2 pi I. Yeah, it shouldn't be. This should be from, the limits are wrong here. This is what I was looking at. It should be from the beginning of the branch point, which was over here, right? It's minus, it's I m squared. So what I want to do is I want to take q goes to I s, and then the s integral I want to take from, let's say I haven't deformed the contour. Let's just leave this as being the logarithm of what I had before. And then what I'll do is I'll take the, no, let's just do it right. So we'll have 2 pi I. And so q here, I should write as being is. And I want s to run from m over square root of x we're going to get minus s squared. We're going to get is. And this is going from m over the square root of x, 1 minus x, to infinity. And this is now minus sr. And I don't need the second term around because when I originally had the variable q, it was going from minus infinity to infinity, so I could make it 0 to infinity and then do the deform the contour. So this thing is going to become if I've done this right, 2 pi over r. Yeah, I'm doing. This contour deformation, I'm doing it really for the modulus of Q. Right? There's a step I didn't do here because Leo deflected me. It's his fault. So let me go back here and write before I take Q to IS, there's a step that I wanted to make explicit that I didn't make explicit. Where's the brush? Let me go back and write this the way I had it before. So I had 2 pi up front. We had the 1 over I r. We had the integral, what was originally integral from 0 to infinity of q squared dq. And then we had the factor e to the I q r minus e to the minus I q r times this logarithm. Times 1 over q, thank you. So the first thing is that I don't have to keep these two terms around. Everything here, I can trade this second term for the contour being from minus infinity to infinity. That's the first observation, is I don't need to follow that one around. So this is now q dq. So now what I'll do is I'll take this contour and deform it to c. And so that'll give us, the limits will become, so we have the 2 pi over ir. We've got the integral now from, it depends. So let's write q is equal to im over the square root of x, 1 minus x, plus is. So that means that we just have to integrate s from 0 to infinity. Now the q dq no, let's not do that. Let's just leave this as is. Otherwise, we're going to have too many factors running around. So we'll have m over the square root of x, 1 minus x. We take two factors of I, we get a sine. We're going to get a minus sine from the q goes to is. We have we're left over with an s, e to the minus sr. And our logarithm became 2 pi I. So I group these terms. What we have is that I has become, so we've got the I's cancel, minus 2 pi squared over r, integral from m over square root of x1 minus x to infinity, ds of s e to the minus s r. That's right. Yes, that's even right. So we can do that integral, and that's just minus 2 pi square root over r, 1 plus mr over square root of x1 minus x, e to the minus mr over the square root of x. And so we can put that back into, so I was just this factor here. So the charge distribution is just that times this. So there's this ambiguous part which came about because because the contour integration didn't treat properly the constant piece in momentum space. But then we have e squared, we have minus e squared over 2 pi cubed r. So the 2 pi to the fifth took out 2 of the 2 pi's. Integral from 0 to 1 dx, x1 minus x. Does that look right? Yes. And you can see that the thing I told you that was going to happen happened. If we had not kept this term and we just looked at this term, this is negative definite. So there's no way that this integral, whatever it is, could integrate to zero if we integrated over all space. And that's inconsistent with what we knew was an exact result. And the reason was that these manipulations that deformed the contour didn't do properly the constant piece of momentum space, and that's why that term is there. So we can figure out what n is because we just asked that by demanding the integral d3x of a to x. And that I'll come back to the interesting part of that integral will be the small r part, which we might already be able to see. Now, the one thing that's gone wrong on me here is I've missed some factors of r. This statement here is wrong. We had the explicit 1 over r here. But when we do this integral, we pick up 2 more factors of r. One way to see that is that we could scale r out of s. And if we did that, then it would come back in here, as it does. But there'd also be 2 factors of 1 over r coming from scaling that. So anyway, so what I want you to notice here is that so for mr much less than 1, so r much less than 1 over m, the exponential goes away, and that goes away. And you can see that eta of r is approximately n delta of r minus e squared over 2 pi cubed r cubed. And this integral, we have to do the integral, which is a number, which I guess we'll have to just evaluate. So the integral, x1 minus x. So what is that? That's x minus x squared, right? So we're going to get x squared over 2 minus x cubed over 3 and 0 and 1. So that'll be 1 half minus 1 third is 1 sixth, right? So this will be 1 sixth. So 2 cubed is 8 times 6. So this, in particular, this factor here is e squared over 48 pi cubed r cubed. And I told you at some time before that that's what the asymptotic form for small r had to be for this charge distribution, those coefficients. And you can kind of see why now, that if you take n, if you ask for, if this, so for small r, if we take the integral, if we try to evaluate n is going to be equal to the, if I use this condition to evaluate n, n is going to be equal to e squared over 2 pi cubed, and the integral from 0 to 1 dx, x1 minus x. And then we have the integral d3r of 1 over r cubed, and then these other factors, 1 plus mr. Now, this for small r is diverging, right? Because this is going like r squared dr over r cubed. And so this is going to go like dr over r. So there's a logarithmic divergence happening here for distances that are very small. So if I cut this off for small distances at a scale lambda inverse, which is what we were doing before, it's like a distance scale, which is lambda is like an energy scale. So lambda inverse would be distance scale. It's very small. And you can see that the divergent part is going to be it's e squared over, that's this factor here, 48 pi cubed, the integral r over r. And then there'll be the various angular integrals here, which would, in this case, would have been 4 pi, right? So that would have been e squared over 12 pi squared log of something over lambda inverse. So let's so that's going to be, if I put the lambda on the top, it'll be lambda over some scale. I'll put m here, but whatever I choose here can be rolled into the order one part. And that's what we recognize, right? This is the kind of logarithmic divergence we're getting in the renormalization of the charge. This n can be thought of as we had a point charge. We thought we had a point charge q times a delta function. That was the bare charge we stuck in. And you can think of this n as being the wave function renormalization, that we acquired this polarization distribution. And if we had the original charge here and we had a little pillbox, because things are so singular near that charge, if we have a little pillbox of size lambda inverse, then the polarization that gets sucked inside that pillbox is now counting as net charge. And so n is keeping track of what gets sucked into that size. And that for small lambda inverse, the divergent part is this. And so the bare, if you thought of the charge that you start off with as being q naught, you know, our complete charge distribution q was q naught plus times the delta function plus eta of r. That was our charge distribution. But now eta of r has a delta function piece too. So this has got a q naught, you know, 1 plus n delta cubed of r plus this piece, which was the smooth part. And you can see that if this is what you thought the bare charge was, then this is the, q naught. This is what you would call the renormalized charge, which is the contribution of the bare charge plus all the polarization charge that got pulled into this little pillbox that you were trying to follow, that you couldn't get down smaller than. And so in that picture, the renormalized charge was the bare charge times 1 plus n, and here's n, 1 minus e squared over 12 pi squared. Which is what we had before, if I've done that right. So the picture hangs together. Is that this kind of beats it to death, but there's really a physical picture that if you stick a charge in the vacuum, it polarizes. You know, the electron positive electron pairs, if you like, are being polarized virtually in the vacuum everywhere, and so there's effectively a polarization distribution around it, which is has no net charge, and that's the statement that the integral of eta is zero. But if you have its singular distribution near the original charge, so if you try and cut it off, saying that you don't know what's going on distances smaller than some scale, then some of this polarization charge leaks in, and then it physically that the you know if this had been a positive charge that you'd stuck in there, if that was a plus, then then preferentially you'd have negative charges that are, the electrons are being attracted to the positive charge and the positrons are being repelled by it. So you would be preferentially getting negative charges pulled through that little wall. And those negative charges are screening effectively the, if all you know is that there's a charge inside that region and you don't, can't get smaller than that region, then you've partially screened the charge you started off with. And this charge distribution that the finite part of the vacuum polarization gives you is precisely capturing the charge that would filter into some small region lambda if that scale lambda is lambda inverse is smaller than the inverse Compton wavelength electron. And so the infinite renormalization that you have is literally capturing that charge leakage, the screening that's coming from this finite part of the vacuum polarization. So the picture of polarization really is a good description of what's going on when you put charges into the vacuum. There's something, you know, an example of this, which maybe might be a good homework example is if you do the same story, if you calculate the Casimir energy between two plates, which is a good thing to do at some point, if you have two conducting boundaries, then there's a famous calculation which shows you that the vacuum energy depends on the separation between these plates, D. And that corresponds to, so the derivative is the force, and so that gives you a force between these two plates. You could ask how virtual electron-positron pairs change that Casimir energy. And there's a calculation of how it changes it. And a very simple way to think about it is that if you take a charge, if you kind of have virtual electron-positron pairs to first approximation, they're not doing anything. But if you have a charge in between these plates, and it's close to the plate, then what happens is that it starts to see its image charge on the other side of the plate, and the vacuum polarization around it. And so if you have charges that are near enough to a boundary, a conducting boundary, they start to pick up a surface interaction, which is to do with seeing the vacuum polarization of electrons once they're within a distance of order 1 over m of the boundary. And you can literally calculate what it is. If you just take this charge distribution we calculated and integrate it along a surface distribution of charge, you can figure out exactly what this interaction would have been. And if that interaction energy, if you use it to perturb the Casimir energy of the two-plate system, gives you the leading contribution to what you would have done if you just calculated the Casimir energy, including electrons, and working to one loop, and just calculated what the vacuum energy was. So there really are physical consequences to this charge distribution that we're talking about. Not that those are measurable or anything, but it's, in principle, it could have been measurable. It's just very hard to measure things that accurately. Any questions about any of that?
About the cutoff, when we're introducing it, we do it once we've imposed the condition of data. If we had imposed it, if we had said that the integral d3x of eta has to be 0 up to some cutoff, then we wouldn't be picking a contribution from the delta function.
I'm not sure what you mean. Yeah, we didn't have an option for this, right? This was just true. Given that this is true, right? That we made pi vanish.
Yeah, I'm just confused because we're imposing a cutoff, but once we're doing it once we've got an expression for n, not before we get our expression for n.
Oh, so the issue there is that the distribution here is not converging, right? That the integral over R. This is going like 1 over r cubed for small r. So this is the volume integral for small r is diverging near the charge. So there's an issue, I think that's probably what you mean, is that there's an issue as to how you define this integral. And that's, so you have the regularization was involved in defining the integral.
Okay.
So effectively, if your regularization is to exclude a small enough region, so you're not integrating over the whole volume, then there's no inconsistency between the statement that you've got an integral which is not 0 and this more general statement that the integral over eta, whatever it was, had to be charge neutral because we knew that pi of 0 was 0. And so it's the exclusion. So you know, so this statement looks really benign because most charge distributions are well enough behaved that the integral converges. And so it's kind of a slippery statement, given that this interval is diverging. So what exactly do you mean? And so this, I would say, is this was true after we have normalized. So the thing is, we just did a calculation, we got some divergent thing, but then the finite part, we defined it in this way on physical grounds. And so that means that once you've renormalized things, the renormalized charge has to satisfy this property. And so there's an issue of what the renormalized charge satisfies and what the regularized charge satisfies. And so that we only start talking about what Q naught is versus, you know, Q bare versus Q not bare once we actually had a little pill box around the charge we stuck in there. And so the distinction between the renormalized and bare charges was coming in at that point, but not before that point. I don't know if that's answering your question or not. Because the regularization is kind of, it's an intermediate step. You're defining, you know, you're defining what these intervals mean given that they're singular. And so then you can ask more precisely how they behave. And once you've regularized, you know, you could have, the issue of whether you were normalized is independent in principle of whether or not things were diverging and you had to regularize. Because in practice, you know, there's some physical definition of what your charge is that you're going to have in mind. And so conditions like this that are renormalization conditions, those are definitions of what you meant by the things in your Lagrangian. And so this was canonical normalization and unit residue of the propagator. But for the charge, it would have been a statement about we measure charge, you know, by using the structure constant in some atom or something and in some energy level. And that's what we mean by charge. And so when we write E, if E means that, it's got a very specific definition, which you would have to specify to numerically know what it was, because ultimately you're gonna figure out what the value of E is by taking some observable and saying, I define this charge in terms of that observable, and I infer this numerical value for alpha 1 over 137 because of the way I've defined it in terms of this observable. And so you do that if things had to diverge or not, because you have to, if you have parameters in your answer, you have to know what the parameters are in order to predict anything. So the numerical values you have to infer from experiments, so you have to tell us what the parameter, you know, what exactly was the definition of the parameter that you're trying to find the value for. Right? I mean, so if you're looking at me funny, like I'm saying something crazy. If the fine structure constant was 1 over 137, that's a meaningless statement unless I told you what the fine structure constant was, right? And I might mean the thing that appears in some shift of some energy level, or I might mean scattering of two charges of known, you know, I take the Coulomb force between two charges at some fixed distance and some known charges, and I define the unit of charge to be the thing that gives me 1 newton or something. There's a lot of ways you could define charge. But there will be some, so you choose one. It doesn't make a difference which one you choose, but there'll be, we can all make different choices. We'll all infer different numbers for our value of E, given our choice. But then when we go off and calculate other things, we're gonna get the same answer for the other things because we all got our value from E from some observable difference. We all took different observables. But the invariant statement is that all the observables had a correlation amongst them that the theory was predicting for you. And how you parameterize that by your charge is up to you. You can use anything you like, but you're ultimately taking the parameter in your Lagrangian and you're eliminating it in terms of some observable. And then you predict other things in terms of that parameter, which you've eliminated in terms of the other observable. So the thing you're actually doing is you're predicting these observables in terms of that observable. And the observable statement, those are all measured things. Everybody has to agree on them. But no, we don't have to agree on the value of the charge that we use to parameterize the halfway step. And so the whole story about the charge, you know, renormalized versus unrenormalized is all about how you're doing precisely parameterizing your theory. And it's the thing that you don't have to care too much about in the end of the day as long as you finish the process and express observables in terms of observables. And then given that things are diverging, it's more subtle because the charges that you're defining are regularization dependent. And so you don't see that until you do regularize things and you start asking. So this is something which we knew just based on our renormalization conditions for the variables. But this is something which we knew once we started regularizing things in terms of some cutoff, and then we could compare the thing that we had inside the box compared to the charge outside the box. So I probably went on too long with that answer. But
anti-screening major for high loops. Are there any general arguments?
That's a good question. There, I think the general statement would be that it depends, theory, it depends on the details of how you define your charge. That you can define things. So the screening, the way I'm describing it, I'm making it sound like all roads lead to road, and if we calculate how charges run, you know, the fact that you're screening means that the charge that you see on this scale is bigger than the, or less than the charge you started off with here because it was physically screened by some opposite charge. And that corresponds to the sine of the beta function. That if we, now that the sine is right, if we ask how big is the charge at short distances, it'll be larger than charges at small distances, which is saying the same thing. And so I'm telling you because the statement for the beta function is that, you know, I said that there's many ways you could define the charge. So you could worry that depending on how you define the charge, you'll get different values for this beta function. And in one loop, the statement is that everybody agrees on the one loop value of the beta function. But at higher loops, the way that the charge runs depends on exactly how you define it.
So, but like even the sign of the charge, you can choose different ways.
Well, you can define in particular all the corrections to one loop to be zero. But there will exist a charge definition for which that'll be true. One loop answer is the answer. But there'll be other charges, you know, that might not be a very physical definition, but there'll be other definitions for which it'll be.
But like physically, what will measure?
So it just depends on how you define the charge. So I think there's no invariant statement you can say just in a blanket way. Like one loop is special because one loop, all the definitions are agreeing for that particular question. So we have, before I let this vacuum polarization go, I wanted to use it a little bit more. So I'm telling you it's got physical consequences, and these are kind of consequences, but you're not really measuring things here so much. But another place you could measure this charge distribution would be an atom. You know, if you have a bound state, if I'm giving you a slightly different charge distribution that you thought you had, and that'll shift all the energy levels around. And so this graph we've done is a contribution to the Lamb shift in atoms. It's the contribution to the Lamb shift in muonic atoms, but it's not the biggest contribution for ordinary atoms. The issue, if I still have this picture here, if we imagine thinking of this being a nucleus, or say this being a nucleus and this being something in an atom, we can imagine the energy levels caring about the fact that we've got a graph like this, and they will in a way that we'll talk about. But you might also worry about these other things. So if we had been talking about regular atoms where this is an electron, these other things would be there, and actually this is the one that turns out to be the most important. It turns out that this vertex correction has a logarithmic divergence, which gives you a log of the fine structure constant, which makes it bigger than all the other contributions for regular atoms. So the thing we're calculating here is a part of the answer, but it's not the biggest part for ordinary atoms. But if we're looking at muonic atoms, and the argument I gave you here applies, that the contribution that we're going to find goes like 1 over m squared. And so contributions like this and like this for muonic atoms are down by the muon mass rather than electron mass. And so this is the thing that's going to dominate if we had done the Lamb shift for a muonic atom. And muonic atoms can be made. They shoot muons into a material, and the muons get trapped by the nucleus. They eventually decay, but before they decay, they cascade down into the various hydrogen-like energy levels. And so you can measure to some accuracy what the energies are of those states. Okay, so what we've claimed to have found here is for non-relativistic particles, the effect of this graph is like having a change to the potential energy of interaction, the Coulomb interaction, to do with a charge distribution where the scale of the charge distribution, you know, the typical, all the action is happening on scales of order 1 over m. So the Compton wavelength of the particle in the loop is the thing that's setting the size of the charge distributions that we're talking about in this kind of picture here, that this distance here would be the Compton wavelength 1 over m. So in an atom, you know, if you have a nucleus, and you've got some energy levels, you know, some electron in an orbit. You know, the typical size of the orbit here is the Bohr radius, which is of the order of 1 over alpha times the reduced mass for whoever's involved here. You know, 1 over mu is, you know, 1 over a nucleus plus 1 over m, whatever the thing is in the loop, in the bound state. And if the charge here is charge, let me not say z, let me say q, then what would appear here is this is the product of the two. Alpha here is you know, e squared over 4 pi. So the one product of each of the charges, this end and this end. So if this one has charge bigger than 1, then there's a factor of q that goes along to the right there. So this is what would have been the Bohr radius for an orbit. So you see that it's if m is much less than the nuclear mass, which is true for electrons and muons, and this is approximately 1 over m, then even if that's electrons, this is 1 over m divided by a small number. So this is a scale which is very large compared to that scale, the Compton wavelength of the electron. So this scale A generically is much bigger than, unless q is enormous, it would be much bigger than 1 over m. So we're talking about changing the potential of the nucleus on distance scales very small compared to the size of the atom, is the upshot of what we've done here. And so if you imagine having a perturbing the energy levels of an atom, you know, at first order in perturbation theory, what you would have expected is that the, you know, the first thing would have been the matrix element of the interaction of the perturbation in the initial state. So that would have been something like integral d3x of psi star of x times whatever the change of the potential was, times psi n of x. That's what we would expect the leading contribution to the energy shift would be. But if this is very, very taking place on this is varying on scales that are very, very short compared to the variation of the wave function, then all the action in this integral, you know, is so there's an integral over some range, and the support of the wave functions is some broad thing, and the support of this thing is some very, very small thing. And so we're getting a contribution, you know, this is zero outside some range essentially, which is extremely short. So effectively, as far as this integral is concerned, these wave functions aren't doing much in the range where you're getting a contribution to the integral. So to a good approximation, you can think of this as being psi n at the origin squared times integral d3x of delta v of x, given that delta v has a range which is extremely short compared to the size of the atom. So if unequal to zero. So this is a simple way to to pick off how our particular vacuum polarization is going to affect things like the energy levels. So, what we first want to do is take what delta V was. So we know that the original potential of the nucleus plus the correction, which is coming from the vacuum polarization, was given by Q1, Q2 over 2, 2 pi cubed. No, two, sorry. Integral d3q right, that's what we had before. So that means that the integral d3r of delta v, well, this is the delta v part here. Will be, if I do the integral over space, so if I just drop the 1, that gives me the delta v part. the integral over space is just going to give me the a delta function, right? Because I'm going to do the integral d3 r. I'll get delta of q, which will do the q integral. And what I'm going to get is it's going to do the q integral at 0, because the integral over r will give me a delta function at q equals 0. So I'm going to get the limit as q squared goes to 0 of what's in the integrand here. So pi f of q squared divided by q squared. Which is another way of writing, you know, pi prime f of 0, where pi prime is what I called before df dq squared. So pi, this is the thing I mistakenly was saying was 0 when I was talking about the renormalization conventions before. Instead of, the right thing was that this was 0, was a renormalization convention, and this doesn't have to be 0. But we can calculate what it is because we know what pi is, and let me just make sure I don't start from the wrong spot. Yeah, so pi, remember, was 2 e squared over 2 pi squared x of x so if you just do the derivative and evaluate it at 0, then you know the log goes to 1 over this, but when we evaluate at 0 it goes away. So pi f prime of 0 will just be 2 e squared over 2 pi squared x 1 minus x. And if I take ddq squared of this, so let me do the ddq squared proper. So if I take derivative of the argument, I get 1 over the argument. Then I have to take derivative of the argument with respect to q squared. So I'm going to get a 1 over m squared times x and 1 minus x again. So you can do that integral, and let me just tell you what the answer is. So if I do it in real time, I'll get it wrong. So it's e squared over 60 pi squared m squared. Or in terms of alpha, that's alpha over 15 m squared. Pi m squared. So it's a known thing. So this thing that's appearing here, you know, we know is a very general statement. And as advertised, it goes like 1 over the mass of the thing in the loop. And so the heavier the thing, if we had kept the vacuum polarization for the muon, it would have been suppressed by the muon mass rather than electron mass. It would have been smaller. So that means that the energy level shift, we just use that in what we had over there. I guess that's calling a delta before. So it'll be sine of 0 squared times integral over v, which is, what I wrote here, remember, involved just unit charges. If I really have charge q here, have charge q1 here and say charge q2 here. Let's just keep those in case we want those to be separate variables. Then we would have had a factor of q1 over q2. Then we would have had this pi of 0, which we just calculated. Right. So this thing here, if you remember how atomic wave functions behave, if you have any, you know, the wave functions are labeled by L, N, and M, you know, where this is the principal quantum number, and then these are the two angular momentum quantum numbers. But what you should remember is that for as r goes to zero, psi n of r essentially goes like r to the L for any non-zero or for all L, and so in particular it vanishes. So psi of zero equals zero if L is not zero. That means that only the S wave states will be the ones for which this thing applies. So what's going to happen is that you're going to differentially shift all the S wave states by this amount, and none of the P waves or any of the other ones are going to change, essentially. Because for them, this factor is vanishing because they're all vanishing near the origin because they all have angular momentum, and so the centripetal force keeps them away from the nucleus. So the way you'd actually measure this would be to look at something like the energy level shift of, you know, it happens that the Lamb shift in particular, you know, so for the Dirac equation, so if you solve the Dirac equation, you know, in a Coulomb background, then there's an exact degeneracy, right? It's the 2s and 2p levels are degenerate. Or one of the 2p levels, because all it really, in the Dirac equation, everything just depends not on L separately, but it depends on the total J. So E depends on J and not L and the electron spin separately. So there's a combination where you can have an S wave and the electron spin being a half. That would give you J equals a half. But you could also have a P wave where L is 1 and electron spin is a half to give you J equals a half. And those two states will have the same value of J. And because of that, they'll have exactly the same energy for the Dirac equation. And so those two states, this kind of a thing will contribute to a splitting because the vacuum polarization will lift this one and it won't lift this one. And so that's kind of why that's the Lamb, what's what the Lamb shift is. So the Lamb shift is the splitting between these nominally degenerate 2s and 2p states. So what we've got here is a contribution to the Lamb shift, and it's the biggest one for muonic atoms, but not for ordinary atoms. So all we need is the wave function for the 2s state, and that's actually pretty simple, because all we need is at the origin. So for the 2s state, the wave function is 1 over the square root of 4 pi times 1 over the Bohr radius to the 3 halves, 2 minus r over a, e to the minus r over a. And a here is 1 over alpha m times the q of the nucleus. So that means that the psi of 0 squared for the state is going to be 1 over pi times 2a cubed. And that would be, if I use a, it's q nucleus cubed, alpha cubed, m cubed over 8 pi. So then that tells us what the shift is. So the lamb shift from the vacuum polarization. We combine that with this. We're going to get Q nucleus to the fourth, Q for the thing that's in the, you know, the muon and electron, times alpha to the fourth. There's an alpha over there. So this is this m is the m of the thing in the orbit, cubed. You've got 15 pi times 8 pi, so that's 80, 120 pi squared electron mass squared. And that's everything, I think, right? So in particular, you know, for regular atoms, this would have been where m is me, this would have been, traditionally you would have called z the charge of the nucleus. This would have been z to the fourth, alpha to the fourth, m over n 20 pi squared. And for muonic atoms, it's z to the fourth. So we, you know, counting the alphas and the m's, you can kind of see why these graphs are not smaller than this graph for atoms. So if we actually ask, what did we expect this thing to give us? So let's ask, estimate that. If we ask kind of how big this would have given us if we had the electron scattering from the nucleus. And what are we expecting to get here? We're expecting to get a factor of z here. And we would have expected to get 1, 2, 3, 4 factors of e. So we would have expected to get z e to the fourth. It's a loop. So we're expecting to get, with the e's, we expected to get an 8 pi squared. And we're expecting that to multiply psi of 0 squared. On dimensional grounds, we're looking for a factor of mass squared here, because this is an energy. This is the wave function has dimensions of 1 over the square root of volume. So this is 1 over volume. And so that means that, you know, 1 over length would have been energy. So we're looking for a factor of length squared here, so that's like a mass squared denominator. And since the only scale in this problem on this side, on the where the loop is m, we expect that to be m squared again. And you can kind of see that that all other things being equal, what it should be comparing to is over here. Here, you know, why didn't I write that down? What happened? I have given you a factor of alpha wrong here, because it's so over here, unfortunately, you know, in the graph that we were doing, you should have objected, because I had two factors of e. Those are those two, but I didn't put in those two factors of e too, right? Those were there, so there should have been a factor here of the of the nuclear charge, so Q nuclear. I guess we had the nuclear charge there already. So when I wrote these things, I had to write factors of E on both of them. I didn't write that explicitly. So those e's should have gone along for the ride here. So we should have had another factor of e squared. E squared over 4 pi squared would have been another factor of alpha, so we would have had alpha to the fifth. And this, we lost a factor of 4, so we've got 120 would have been 30. And we lost a pi. There we go, that's better. But this shows you that these factors here that you're getting from that graph are identical to what you're getting in this graph. We have the 2 factors of E, 4 factors of E, 1 over m squared, and the 8 pi squareds. So that shows you that this graph wants to compete with this graph, but that's something you knew anyway, because we already knew that for a fixed number of external lines, what counts is the number of loops. That's the thing that suppresses graphs is loops, and the E squareds over 8 pi squareds were counting loops. The thing that's not obvious is that whenever you connect 2 external lines by a massless state, like this in this case, which is not happening here, there's massless states here are connecting external lines to internal lines. But here there's a massless state that's connecting 2 external lines. That always gives you an infrared divergence. And that infrared divergence turns into a logarithm of 1 over alpha, the fine structure constant. And you know, 1 over alpha is 137, so the logarithm is something which is 10 or 20 or something like that. And that logarithm makes this thing makes this graph beat this graph. But all the other factors were the same. But for muons, you can kind of see why the things we were saying before, it wouldn't be true that those graphs are dominating. Because for muons, we have this contribution, and all these other contributions involving corrections to the muonic line are going to scale like 1 over the muon mass squared, and so they're not going to have this enhancement factor. And that's the thing that's going to win over any factors like log of alpha. Okay, so the message there was mostly that you can measure these things. And one of the huge successes of quantum electrodynamics is assembling all these terms for the Lamb shift and seeing that they really capture what is measured for that energy level shift. So next class, what I want to do is we're working our way through the one loop things. You're doing the self-energy and the homework. I want to look at the vertex correction in that one loop. And along the way, that gives us the muon and electron anomalous magnetic moments. And it's a similar story in which we'll renormalize things. And we'll extract the non-relativistic limit of the vertex correction in order to see what its physical consequences are. And in particular for magnetic moment, we'll look for, in a magnetic field, what would be the energy level shifts. And we'll look for something looking like magnetic moment dot B. And that'll allow us to read off what the magnetic moment of the electron is and how these radiative corrections change it. And that's, of course, another one of the classic tests of QED. And then from there, I'm going to switch back and fill in the missing steps on path integrals and canonical quantization of QED and why path integrals are the only sane way to do it. And then we'll do the other topics that I gave in the original syllabus, like the LSC reduction and that kind of thing.